They are constantly scouting for new talent and culling their current roster. You're building a team, not raising a family. Some members of your team may simply not be able to grow into high performers for the future you're heading to. It's not the job of the business to invest in developing them. The job is to develop the product and market. Develop and promote from within when that's the best option for performance. When it's better to hire from outside, be proactive in doing so. The ideal is for people to take charge of developing themselves. This drives optimal growth for both individuals and companies. Questions to consider. Have you systematically assessed the skills of all members of your team against the capabilities you will need in 6 months to a year? Are there some ways of working, such as programming and working with robots, collaborating cross-functionally, or mapping out and redesigning the customer experience, in which you can foresee your team will need strong experience? Would your team's performance be significantly boosted if you brought in a new top performer or several, even if the cost of those hires would mean scaling down the size of your team? What opportunities do you see on the horizon that your team could begin capitalizing on now if you brought in some new talent? Perhaps there is a new technology that would allow you to offer a new or better service or product. Maybe a competitor is leaving market share vulnerable or a new market is developing. In which areas is your team or company at the vanguard of innovation, with leading talent spearheading the effort? And in which are you running as fast as you can to catch up, or soon will find yourself in that situation if you don't make some new hires? How much of your time are you spending on the development of your team's skills? And how satisfied are you with how quickly people are getting up to the speed you need? And now, Chapter 6.
Chapter 6. Someone really smart in every job. Have the right person in every single position. At Netflix, we had three fundamental tenets to our talent management philosophy. First, the responsibility for hiring great people and for determining whether someone should move on rested primarily with managers. Second, for every job, we tried to hire a person who would be a great fit, not just adequate. Finally, we would be willing to say goodbye to even very good people if their skills no longer matched the work we needed done. As John Cincuti, who is one of our best hiring managers, said to me, knowing when it's time for people to move on goes hand in hand with bringing in top performers with the skills you need. They are two sides of the same coin. If you're not great at hiring high-talent people, then you cannot truly be comfortable letting good people go. You'll never be good at one without the other, and you'll never be good at building a high-performance team. This approach allowed us to dynamically and proactively create the teams we needed to reach the goals we were heading toward, not getting bogged down by teams that were outmoded and struggling desperately to evolve. John totally embraced our talent management philosophy, and he's taken it with him in his endeavors since leaving Netflix, such as building up a great team at Coursera and staffing the team at 60DB, which he currently runs. He wrote a great piece for First Round Review about his specific tactics for hiring great people. This is how Coursera competes against Google and Facebook for the best talent, which I highly recommend. His passion for the subject and his development of such detailed methods speaks of how seriously so many of our hiring managers took their team-building responsibility. In fact, we stress to all hiring managers that building a great team was their most important job. My HR team and I closely coach them about how to do great sourcing and interviewing, how to close the deal with candidates, how to evaluate when to part ways, and how to talk about the decision not only to the person but also to the rest of the team. Be a great company to be from. That early morning, Reed called to ask me to join Netflix. After I asked him to tell me what his ideal company would be, he asked me the same question. I told him that my ideal company would be one that was a great place to be from, like having been at Apple or Microsoft in the early days. I said that because I've seen two consistent truths about the best companies and the best employees. The most competitive companies are able to stay limber, always innovating and growing, largely because they are always proactively bringing in the new talent that they need. The best employees are always looking for challenging new opportunities, and though they are usually intensely loyal, many of them will eventually seek those opportunities elsewhere. You can never know when they might decide to make a move, and often there's nothing you can do to stop them. Earlier, I mentioned Eric Colson. In less than 3 years, he rose from a data analyst position to the role of VP of Data Science and Engineering, reporting directly to Reed and managing four big, very important teams. He had never expected to be given so much responsibility, and certainly not so fast. He told me recently that he was, and still is, hugely grateful for the opportunities offered to him. He also loved the work he was doing at Netflix. He was managing teams at the forefront of applying all the sexy new tools of big data, like machine learning. Yet he came to me one day after 3 years in the role and told me he was going to work for a tiny startup called Stitch Fix, which uses data analysis combined with input from personal stylists to send clients recommended clothes for purchase. I thought, what? He's going to work on shipping clothing in boxes? Eric, are you all right? He said the company was going to be like the Netflix of clothes. I still didn't get it, and I asked him why he was interested. All of a sudden, he lit up with the possibilities, and I said to him, "You're in love with the data, aren't you?" He left, and as Stitch Fix's chief algorithms officer, he's led the development of highly innovative algorithms and a novel approach to combining machine learning with human stylists' insight that have propelled the company to rapid growth. We tried very, very hard to keep great people at Netflix whose skills and experience we needed, but we were operating in an extremely competitive talent pool. We recognized that we had to be highly proactive about creating a pipeline of top talent. On the flip side, because of how fast our business was changing, we also had to be willing to part with people whose skills we no longer needed, even if they had done a great job and were wonderfully talented. Our overriding talent management mandate had to be building the best team for the future we were creating. This is why I say that retention is not a good metric by which to evaluate your team building success or whether you've created a great culture. The measure should not be simply how many people you are keeping, but how many great people you have with the skills and experience you need. How many of them are you keeping? How many new people with the skills and experience you need are you hiring? You also want to closely monitor how rigorously you are evaluating who you need to replace and how efficiently you're acting on that determination. I'm not saying that adopting this perspective and reliably acting on it is easy. It's hard enough letting people go who aren't performing. It's even more difficult to let people go who have done a great job. But what helps is knowing that they have a great resume because they've worked for you. That will be a huge assist in finding the next job. You can also actively help them. The single best way in which companies can ensure that people who leave are able to find great opportunities elsewhere is to make the company one that's known to be intensely driven to hire top talent. If managers operate this way, they can become masterful at good goodbyes. More on that in Chapter 8. For now, let's focus on great hellos. Great work is not about the perks. The perk wars have escalated to an absurd level. A few months ago, I was asked to come speak to the whole staff of a startup, probably 100 people. During the Q&A after my talk, one of the employees raised his hand and said, "I have a very important question to ask you. How do you feel about departmental kegerators versus a company kegerator?" At the time, this company had swings and hammocks strewn around its offices. To the audience member, I responded, "What kind of question is that? You know how a business works, right?" He said, "I don't understand what you're asking." And I told him, "Well, you make a service available to your customers and they give you money for it. That money pays for the cost of operating, and what's left over is profit. That's the essence of business. It has nothing to do with kegerators. Companies don't exist to make happy employees." I looked around the room and people were clearly shocked. I then explained that it's absolutely great for employees to be happy, but it's best for both them and their companies if the reason they're happy is that they're doing great work with great people. I've actually been asked by one executive, "Should I worry that we don't have a bartender or a personal chef?" If someone wants to walk out your door and go to another company because it serves better craft beer, You should just say to that person, "Have fun. Oh, and let's do happy hour at your place soon." People's happiness in their work is not about gourmet salads or sleeping pods or foosball tables. True and abiding happiness at work comes from being deeply engaged in solving a problem with talented people you know are also deeply engaged in solving it, and from knowing the customer loves the product or service that you've worked so hard to make. Money doesn't buy love. We decided over time at Netflix to pay highly competitive salaries. We had to compete with Google and Facebook and Amazon for top technical talent, and we believed in paying top dollar for the talented people we needed. But we did not want to be competing on price as a core lever of convincing people to join the company. Word certainly got round that we paid very well, and there's no question that that helped us to bring in the people we wanted. But we had a rule that we wouldn't discuss compensation with candidates until we knew they wanted to accept the offer. We would talk about our philosophy on compensation, but we wouldn't talk numbers. In my experience, when people bring up money fairly early in the interviewing process, they are either underpaid in their current job, or being paid very well and worried that you won't be able to improve on that, or are primarily interested in the money and not truly passionate about the job. We had no interest in hiring people because they were underpaid, and we could get their talents on the cheap. We were also generally not concerned that we would be unable to make a high enough offer if we really wanted to hire the person. We had not set up rigid compensation systems, as so many companies do, with their bell curve distributions and 6% merit increase budgets and strict salary bands. We were free to offer what we needed to offer, so we had no good reason to talk numbers up front. As for candidates who are mostly interested in the money, we wanted to weed them out. We would tell them, "We don't think you're right for us. We think at this point in your career it's important for you to chase the money. If that's what's up, then go to one of our competitors." We also didn't have a bonus system. If your employees are adults who put the company first, an annual bonus won't make them work harder or smarter. We handled equity compensation in a completely different way than most companies do. We allowed employees to tell us what portion of their compensation they wanted in stock options. And rather than adding those to their salary, the amount was in lieu of a portion of their salary. In addition, rather than using stock options as golden handcuffs, we imposed no vesting period. Options would vest on a monthly basis. Those options were available to exercise for 10 years, allowing for long-term increase in the stock price. I was talking to Warby Parker CEO Neil Blumenthal, and he told me that he wanted my advice about creating an executive bonus program. I asked him, "Okay, you want it to be a combination of equity and cash?" "Yep." "And you want it to be based on company goals, team goals, department goals, and individual goals?" "Yep." Then I asked him, "Didn't you tell me when we last talked that you were opening up more stores? And didn't we discuss that there was a 50-50 chance that that strategy was going to work out? So now you want to set up a very complicated system that you have to explain to finance, and you have to explain to the board, and you have to explain to the stock committee. If they agree, then you have to set up the software so you can track the results versus the goals. When you know that, you don't really know whether or not these goals are realistic." He said, "But I want to reward them." And I said, "Well, if you hit all your targets and everything works out, great. Give them a ton of money. Throw stock at them. You don't need a bonus system tied to goals. I know you and I know your team. And I know that a bonus program is not going to incent them to do anything that they're not going to do anyway." Motivation is about talent density and appealing challenges. We didn't understand right away at Netflix that great colleagues and tough challenges to tackle were the strongest draws to working at the company. But very early on, we understood that we had to be really rigorous about maintaining our talent density. We couldn't make any promises to people about long-term careers at the company. We were quite open about that, and over time, we found it was no deterrent to attracting top performers. When I talked to John Cincuti about this, he beautifully expressed what we hoped would be the way employees thought about our approach. After the 2001 layoff, the talent density at the company became amazing. The executive team started to talk about how Netflix was a company where amazing people who are high-functioning and can go on and do great things at other places. What I heard was, "Don't expect there to be a long-term path for you. But working with amazing people and the opportunity to grow were even more important to me than having an explicit promise of a path for promotion. The diversity of brilliance. Netflix was always being compared to Google, and we often competed for the same talent. But the two companies have totally different approaches to hiring because they have such different approaches to growing their businesses. Google was a tough, tough competitor to go up against for hiring managers. But we were able to, again and again, bring in top talent that might have gone to Google because we articulated so clearly what our approach to building teams and managing people was, and we didn't try to compete on Google's terms. I had worked with Eric Schmidt at Sun, and I realized that Google reminded me of the go-go days at Sun, when we focused primarily on hiring as many amazing people as we could, but that Google was even better at doing that because it had such a broad goal: to organize all the world's information. I mean, can you have a broader goal than that? So it makes great sense for Google to hire as many smart people as it can, put them in an environment where they have all the resources they could need, ask them to bubble up tons of ideas, and skim the best of those off the top. Its leaders want to drive the company forward in many different ways. Quantity for them matters a great deal. At Netflix, we were doing essentially one thing, so we needed exactly the right people with the right skills and experience to do their part of that one thing. I would say to people in the recruiting process, if you want your mind to be free and you want to think of all kinds of radical things that may or may not happen, then Google's the place for you. We do one thing. We exist to serve our customers' happiness as a result of that particular product. So if that's not your passion, then go to Google. It's a great company, just very different. I really dislike the term A player. It implies that there is some grading system that can determine who will be best for a position. HR people always ask me how Netflix manages to hire only A players. And I say, you know, there's this island that's populated exclusively by A players, and only some of us know where it is. Making great hires is about making great matches. One company's A player might be a B player for another firm, and vice versa. There's no generic formula for what makes people successful, despite a great deal of effort and all sorts of assessments to try to come up with one. Many of the people we let go from Netflix because they were not excelling at what they were doing at the time went on to excel at other jobs. Finding the right people is also not primarily about culture fit. What most people really mean when they think someone is a good culture fit is that the candidate is someone they'd like to have a beer with. That approach is often totally wrong-headed. People can have all sorts of personalities and be great fits for the job you need done. One of our great hires was Anthony Park, who was working as a programmer for a bank in Arizona when we reached out to him. On paper, he certainly didn't look like a slam dunk fit. He was a programmer, not a software developer. He was also a pretty buttoned up, quiet guy, so I worried a little about how he'd cope with our debate-like crazy culture. We called him because someone had told me that he had created a Netflix-enhancing app, which he had posted on his website. We brought him in for a day of interviews, and everyone loved him, as well as the app he had created. When he got to me, shortly after we started talking, he turned bright red. I asked him if he was okay, and he said, "You're going to make me an offer, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, we are." And he said, "And you're going to pay me a lot of money, right?" And I said, "Well, you're not programming for a bank anymore. You know you'd be here in Silicon Valley, and it's expensive to live out here. We're going to pay you commensurate with what it will take for you to have a great life with your family here." He seemed overwhelmed, and I asked again if he was all right. He said with amazement, "You're going to pay me a lot of money to do what I love to do?" I did wonder how he'd fit in with the high-powered team he was joining, and I hope they wouldn't burn him out in a couple of weeks. A few months later, I sat in on a meeting his team was having, and it was really intense. Everyone was arguing, and he suddenly said, "Can I speak now?" The room went silent, because Anthony didn't say much, but when he did, it was to say something really smart. Over time, everybody learned to pause and wait for him, and he would always say something that would make us all think, "Damn it, why didn't we think of that?" Now, he's a vice president. Organizations can adapt to many people's styles. Culture fit can work both ways. Getting under the resume. We had to be very creative about where we look for talent because we so often had to find people with rarefied technical skills. When we were looking for big data experts, no one really knew what big meant. We couldn't just search resumes and do keyword matching. Our recruiters had to imagine across the universe of all the different kinds of companies that handled masses of data. Many of them at first were insurance or credit card companies. What's more, our recruiting team didn't have much of the knowledge to probe into people's technical skills. Our best recruiter of technical people was Bethany Brodsky. She knew virtually nothing about technology before coming to Netflix, but she was great at understanding our business and the root problems that had to be solved. She understood that more important than the match of a person's prior experience was the match of their approach to problem solving. Bethany told me that one of her best interviews was with a guy that we ended up hiring who was working at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, a government research center that focuses on nuclear science. This was when Netflix was first getting into streaming and was only on a few devices, Xbox, Roku, and TiVo. In interviews, Bethany told candidates that we had signed up 1 million new subscribers in just 30 days on one of these devices, and she asked which one they thought it was. TiVo was really taking off then, so most people said TiVo for sure. But this guy asked her whether there were any special conditions attached to getting a Netflix subscription on any of the devices. She told him that yes, in fact, for the Xbox, you had to have a gold membership. He reasoned that it must be the Xbox. Since those users were already willing to pay a premium, they would probably be more inclined to pay the extra for Netflix. He was right, and that's when she knew he was our guy. I had a similar aha moment about a candidate when I interviewed Christian Kaiser, who worked at AOL managing a group of 25 programmers. I had talked to quite a few people from his group because they were doing technical work similar to something we needed done. But they all wanted to stay at AOL. At this point, Netflix was a much sexier place to work than AOL, so I was perplexed as to why they didn't want to move. When I asked them, they would say, "I have the most amazing boss. He's the best communicator I've ever known. I can't bear the thought of leaving him." So I said to my recruiters, "Go get that guy." I was amazed when he came in. Not only did he have a very thick German accent, but he also stuttered. This guy was the great communicator? On top of that, he was clearly nervous. After all, he hadn't interviewed for many years. It was truly painful for him and me. But when I asked him if he could explain to me, in really simple terms, this incredibly complicated technical work he was doing, he just transformed. He still stuttered, but he gave me a riveting explanation, and I realized, that's it. He's great at making really complicated things understandable. He was an amazing team builder for Netflix. He also left teams he had built in order to lead new projects simply because they needed to get done. He redefined what my team meant by creating such good teams that they could carry on without him. We always tried to be creative about probing more deeply with people and also more deeply into their resumes. Bethany once decided to analyze all of the resumes of all of the data science people we had hired who were really good to see if she could find any common features. And she did. They shared an avid interest in music. From then on, she and her recruiting team would probe into people's interest in music when interviewing for those jobs. She recalled, "We'd get really excited and call out, 'Hey, I found a guy who plays the piano.'" She concluded that these people could easily toggle between their left brains and their right brains, a great skill for data analysis. Build a culture of hiring. The technical nature of our business at Netflix was a key reason it was important that managers be so engaged in the hiring process. But I think the same should be demanded at all companies. All managers should understand really deeply what the company's approach to hiring is and how to execute on it, down to every detail. Bethany once worked with Reed on filling a director position. They met on a Thursday morning to discuss what kind of candidate they were looking for. The next afternoon, Reed sent her an email telling her that he had sent messages to 20 prospects he had found on LinkedIn, and he'd gotten 3 responses. He had also gone ahead and had a Skype session with one of them, really liked them, and wanted to have him come in on Monday. When hiring managers are so engaged, that makes recruiters only all the more competitive. Bethany told me that after she got that message from Reed, she became determined to find someone even better. We ended up hiring Reed's guy, and Reed gloated about it for years. Our recruiter's job was to coach our hiring managers, and they created a slide deck to go over with every one of them, one-on-one. They would ask every hiring manager, "What's your interview process look like? What's your interview team look like? What's your structure around having people coming in for interviews look like?" People don't always have to approach interviewing or sourcing the same way. Our best hiring managers had all sorts of different ways of finding and fielding candidates. We had a saying, "Always be recruiting." Candidates came from everywhere, from professional conferences to the sidelines of kids' soccer games to conversations on airplanes. But certain fundamentals should be strictly enforced. I set an ironclad rule that if anyone saw a stranger sitting by themselves waiting for an interview, they should stop and say, "Hi, I'm..." "Who are you? Are you here for an interview? Who are you waiting for? Let's take a look at your schedule for today, and I'll help you find the next person." I knew the message was heard loud and clear, because if I was ever late coming to meet with a candidate, I'd say, "Sorry, I hope someone talked to you," and they'd say, "Six people talked to me." Interviews trumped any meeting that a hiring manager was scheduled for, and they were the only reason that attendees of our executive staff could miss that meeting or leave it early. Really. Candidates are evaluating you just as you're evaluating them. People forget that. Our goal was for every single person who came in for an interview to walk away wanting the job, even if we hated them. We wanted them to think, "Wow, that was an incredible experience. It was efficient, it was effective, it was on time, the questions were relevant, people were smart, and I was treated with dignity." I would tell people, "Even if this person isn't the right fit, we might love their next-door neighbor." In the end, it was the hiring manager's responsibility to make the decision. Team members would provide input, my team and I would also weigh in, but the ultimate responsibility was with that manager, as was the performance of the team they were building. We acted as quickly as possible once the decision was made. No running the hire by two levels of management, the compensation department, and HR for approval. People from my team worked directly with hiring managers to determine compensation, as well as title and any other detail on the offers. Recruiters laid the groundwork, managers made the offers. Speed and efficiency often meant we could close candidates who were interviewing with other great companies. The interview and hiring process gives a powerful first impression about how your company operates, for good and for bad. Your HR people must be business people. I was at a startup the other day talking to their head of people, and she told me they were planning an offsite to talk about how her team could be more effective in getting new employees up and running in their jobs. She asked me, "Should I invite the recruiters to the offsite?" She seriously didn't know whether or not the people whose specific job it was to assist in hiring new staff should be invited to the meeting about onboarding new staff. The sad truth is that most companies treat recruitment as a separate non-business, even non-HR function. And many young companies outsource it or have only people who are record keepers and ticket takers, administrators, and agenda fillers inside. Over time, our strategy evolved to creating an internal recruiting firm, and a top quality one, because I wanted the highest quality candidates possible. I brought in Jessica Neal from an outside firm to take charge of running that team. Building up a talented team was a substantial investment, but I was able to make an irrefutable business case for doing so. I could clearly show what the return would be from eliminating outside headhunter fees, and we saved bundles of money over time. I also made it totally clear to the recruiting team that they were considered vital contributors to building the business, and they had to deeply understand the needs of the business. The flip side was that the hiring managers really began to treat the HR team as their business partners. I told my staff, "We are a service organization, but it's not spelled S-E-R-V-A-N-T. We weren't in service to the hiring managers. We were in service to the customers of Netflix. I wanted my people to understand that they had to know the customer's needs and desires, as well as the product managers and marketers. They also had to have the same level of understanding and feel a deep connection to creating the product. One of the great cases of our recruiters playing a crucial role in building the business was when we wanted to go into the games business. We had to negotiate deals for every gaming device. We got the Xbox first, and then we wanted to get in the Nintendo Wii. This was another leap into a really different business for us. The development cycles for hardware devices were many years long, and we were an internet company used to pushing new code every couple of weeks. When we finally got the good news that we had made a deal with Nintendo, I asked the head of the team developing for Wii, "So, have we got anybody here who knows anything about Nintendo hardware?" We didn't. And when I asked him how much time we had to get our Wii products developed, he told me about 8 months. If we didn't make that deadline, we'd have to wait 2 years before we could get on the Wii again. I went into my office and immediately called Bethany Brodsky and told her, "Stop what you're doing, come in here right now. We have to brainstorm how we're going to create a Wii team." Fast forward 8 months, and we're having a big party celebrating our launch of the Wii. Bethany was standing next to me. I saw that she was misty-eyed, and I asked her if anything was wrong. She said, "No, I built that team. I helped ship the Wii today." And when the team was asked to say a few words, they said, "Thanks to Bethany Brodsky, because without her, we wouldn't be here today." That was what I wanted our recruiters to feel about their contribution to the business, and what I wanted all managers to feel about the value of our recruiters. Getting them working optimally together requires holding hiring managers accountable. One day, I overheard one of my best recruiters saying that a new executive wasn't engaging with her in a serious way. "He doesn't return my calls. He doesn't return my emails. I send him resumes and he doesn't respond. I'm so frustrated because we really need to build him a great team, and I feel like I'm letting the company down." So I walked up to her and I said, "I think you need to work with someone else. I'll take care of this." Then I sent him an email telling him that I had reassigned his recruiter. "I've put her on another project because you appear to have a methodology for hiring and don't seem to need her help. Let us know when we can help you and step in and assist. Love, Patty." Within minutes, he was at my desk fuming. "What the hell?" So I asked him, "Is it true that she set up 2 meetings with you and you canceled?" He snapped back, "I'm a busy guy, you know. I'm doing the work of 10 people. So I ask, "Is it true that she sent you a number of qualified candidates and you didn't respond? Look, just so you know, it's your job to build the team, not hers. By the way, there are 3 other people who are delighted that she's not spending time on you. She's amazing. She's a great partner. She can really make this work for you. But hey, if you don't need her, that's cool." It infuriates me when I hear hiring managers dismiss the value of good HR people. Usually, when I would ask managers why they weren't engaging with recruiters more, they'd say, "Well, you know, they're not that smart, and they don't really understand what's going on in my business or how the technology works." My response was, "Well, then start expecting and demanding that they do, and hire people who are smart. If you hire smart people and you insist they be business people and you include them in running the business, then they'll act like business people." I even occasionally advise companies to hire a business person to run HR, not an HR specialist. That person should be able to understand the details of your business, how you earn your revenue, who your customers are, and your strategy for the future, just like any other department or division head. One of the reasons I'm no fan of the annual performance review process is not only does it take up a lot of your HR department's time, but it is so often removed from any true connection to business results and serving customers. I asked one very senior HR executive from a Fortune 100 company that I consulted to, "Can you tell me what business metric is affected by the completion of your annual performance review?" He said, "I don't understand the question, Patty." I repeated, "What business metric is directly affected by the completion of the annual performance review?" He said, "Again, I'm not sure what you're asking." So I said, "Might it be revenue, growth, profit? You know, the metrics that we measure our business with?" Then I asked him how much of his staff's time was consumed by the process, and he said, "I really have no idea, but it's worth it." Nowhere else in our companies are we allowed to justify something that takes such incredible effort with merely a feeling that it's worth it. Just imagine if, instead of spending so much time on the review process, all of your people were spending that time collaborating to bring in extraordinary talent that accomplishes amazing products or services for your customers.
In brief, hiring great performers is a hiring manager's most important job. Hiring managers should actively develop their own pipelines of talent and take the lead in all aspects of the hiring process. They are the lead recruiters. The teams and companies most successful in staying ahead of the curve manage to do so because they proactively replenish their talent pool. Retention is not a good measure of team-building success. Having a great person in every single position on the team is the best measure. Sometimes it's important to let even people who have done a great job go in order to make space for high performers in new functions or with different skills. Bonuses, stock options, high salaries, and even a clear path to promotion are not the strongest draw for high performers. The opportunity to work with teams of other high performers whom they learn from and find it exhilarating to work with is by far the most powerful lure. Making a great hire is not about bringing in an A player. It's about finding a great match for your needs. Someone who is a high performer for one team may not be for another team. Get beyond the resume. Be really creative about where you look for talent. Dig further than a list of experiences. Consider wide-ranging experiences and focus on people's fundamental problem-solving abilities. Make the interviewing experience extremely impressive all the way through. You want every single person you interview to want to join the company at the end of the process. HR must be business people who truly understand the way your business works, even if that's quite technical. They should be creative, proactive partners in the hiring process. Investing time in explaining to them the details of the talents you need will pay remarkable dividends. Questions to consider. Can you name the two people you would call right away to talk to about taking the place of your top performers should they leave? What change is underway in your business? How prepared are you to begin interviewing for the new talent you need in the event the change happens faster than you've expected? How creative are you in looking for candidates? Have you devoted time to cultivating lead generators among your professional network? Do you consider finding candidates to be primarily your responsibility, or do you wait for recruiters to find them? How thoughtful and rigorous is the interview process your candidates go through? How well do you think the recruiters working with you understand the details of the jobs to be filled and the qualities you are looking for in hires? And now, Chapter 7.
Chapter 7. Pay people what they're worth to you. Compensation is a judgment call. One of the most challenging topics that I consult about is compensation. Offering competitive salaries is obviously one of the requisites of hiring top talent. But while most every business would like to market salaries to the market, doing so is often a daunting challenge. We have plentiful resources to tap for salary information from a range of industry surveys, which cover every domain and offer an elaborate breakdown of levels. They're amazingly sophisticated. But the issue is that jobs are not widgets and neither are people. And any role you need filled is likely specialized in ways that the survey job descriptions cannot possibly truly account for. Meanwhile, any potential recruit may have skills that can't be measured by surveys, like good judgment and collaborative prowess. Say you need a software engineer. Great. Do you want a senior programmer fluent in the best new techniques in search engine development? And this person also has to know how to manage a staff of 5? Oh, and you also need this person to understand online advertising systems well enough to work effectively with marketing on developing an online advertising strategy? A salary survey is not going to tell you how much that person is paid or should be paid by you. Compensation departments end up spending gobs of time comparing descriptions and making the best calculations they can do to adjust for all these factors. But of course, that process still only gives you a baseline understanding of the true market landscape. How many people with that set of qualifications are available? Many times, as HR professionals or hiring managers know too well, to get the person you really want, you're going to have to essentially throw your calculations away and respond to the actual market demand. But I found that market demand is still not adequate as a guide for the compensation you should offer, because it is of the current moment, while hiring should be about the future. The way I like to think about this is that the prevailing compensation system is often in arrears. It's behind the curve in helping us calculate the value of many hires. Say your recruiter manages to bring in the software engineer with all those particular credentials you need, and you all love her, but she has another offer from your main competitor, and it's a good deal higher, let's say $35,000 or more than you're prepared to pay. In determining what to offer, you should consider the difference it could make to the future of your business if you bring in this really great engineer with all the skills and experience you need, rather than your second-choice candidate, who may be a quite distant second choice and whom it will take another 3 months to hire because you'll keep looking for the person with all the skills and talents of your first choice. How much extra revenue might that great first choice be able to produce? Might she be able to ensure that you beat out your competitor on the launch of a fabulous new search system? Especially if she gets started now instead of 3 months down the road. How much ad revenue might she help bring in by notching up your targeting? What about the value of her management experience? Might a really good member of her team who gets an offer at another firm decide to stay because she's a great team leader? That's not to mention the value to you of her not working for your competitor, especially if your domain is in a period of rapid innovation. Neither current market demand nor salary surveys can help you calculate these future ads. I'm not saying that there's no value in benchmarking with salary surveys, but I do advise curtailing elaborate efforts to compare apples and oranges regarding what other people are paying and to work out what others are paying now. It's better to focus more on what you can afford to pay for the performance you want and the future you're heading to. Separate performance review and compensation systems. One of the first things I did at Netflix was to decouple our pay systems from the feedback process. I appreciate that it's difficult to accept that this is possible, let alone advisable. The systems have become seemingly inextricably intertwined. Indeed, the tight bond between the performance review process and salary increase and bonus calculations is one of the main factors holding companies back from doing away with the review process, which is one of the good reasons for decoupling the systems. Resistance to the notion of disassociating them stems largely from what seems to be slam-dunk logic of tying them together. Typically, managers' reviews of their direct reports, and sometimes reviews of managers by their direct reports, and peer reviews too, are fed into a program, and then recommended salary increases are generated according to predetermined ranges and pegged to departmental results, division results, and company results. A better performance review would seem to mean that the person is worth more to the company. So why isn't that a great way to figure out what you should pay them? Apart from how ridiculously time-consuming and ineffective the annual performance review system is, about which more later, the method of calculating compensation fails to take into account some key factors that should go into salary decisions. One is how valuable the skills employees have developed while they've been working for you have become. Account for the value of working for you. I didn't always think there was a way to calculate salaries other than tying pay to performance reviews. I thought the annual review and compensation calculation process was ludicrously complex and I hated doing it, but I thought it made basic sense. I was enlightened when at Netflix we started losing people recruited away with exorbitant salary offers from our competitors. One day I heard that Google had offered one of our folks almost twice his current pay, and I hit the roof. His management panicked because he was a really important guy, and they wanted to counter. I was adamant that there was no way we were going to pay him that much. I got into a heated email exchange with his manager and a couple of VPs, and I argued, Google shouldn't decide the salaries for everybody just because they have more money than God. We bickered about it for days, even through the whole weekend. They kept telling me, you don't understand how good he is. I was having none of it. But then I woke up on Sunday morning and I said to myself, oh, of course. No wonder Google wants him. They're right. He had been working on some incredibly valuable personalization technology, and very few people in the world had his expertise in that area. I realized that his work with us had given him a whole new market value. I quickly fired off another email. I was wrong, and by the way, I went through the P&L, and we can double the salaries of everybody on this team, and it's really fine. This experience changed our thinking about compensation. We realized that for some jobs, we were creating our own expertise in scarcity, and that rigidly adhering to internal salary ranges could actually be harming our best contributors financially because they could make more money elsewhere. We decided that we didn't want to use a system where people had to leave to get paid what they were worth. We also encouraged our people to interview regularly. That was the most reliable and efficient way to find out how competitive our pay was. The value of paying top of market. We also realized that setting predetermined salary ranges by marking our compensation to some percentile of the top of the market rate, which is common practice, wasn't going to ensure that we hired the density of top performers we needed. We decided we would endeavor to pay the top of market. Many people I consult with say they are marking their pay to market at some percentile, say the 65th percent. Though some people think that means their company is paying 65% of the top market salary for any given role. What it really means is 65% of the people in that role industry-wide are paid less, and 35% are paid more. That might sound good, but not only is the math questionable, because again, positions can't really be compared so strictly, but is often not going to get you the best people that you want to bring in. And it's entirely distanced from a calculation of the results you want to see. Marking to market should not mean pegging your compensation to some fixed rate vis-a-vis the overall market range. It should mean estimating the overall market value of the work a person will do for you in the time frame you need to get it done. People say to me all the time, but we can't afford to pay top of market. Paying top of market was great for Netflix. The company was booming. We're not growing that way, and we don't have the margin. Fair enough. Maybe it's simply not possible, at least not in the near term, to go for top of market for every position. Then, I suggest identifying positions that have the greatest potential to boost your performance and paying top of market to fill them with the best people you can get. Think about this. What if, by paying top of market, you could bring in one supremely talented and experienced person who could do the job of two people, or even add more value than that? Consider the well-known 80-20 rule regarding sales teams, that 20% of your company's salespeople will generate 80% of your sales revenue. That rule might apply much more widely to other types of employees. I know I've seen a comparable effect in team after team. An interesting study done by Bain and described in the Harvard Business Review article provides strong support for the value of this strategy. The study analyzed the distribution of talent in 25 global companies and found that on average, only 15% of employees were performance stars. But a big difference between the most successful companies and the rest was the nature of the roles the stars were in. The authors wrote, "The best companies used intentional non-egalitarianism, meaning they focus their stars on areas where these individuals can have the biggest impact on company performance. As a result, the vast majority of business-critical roles, up to 95%, are filled by A-quality talent. At other companies, stars are distributed broadly across the departments." Another objection I often hear to bringing in star performance at top-of-market pay is that their salaries will be so much higher than those of their new teammates. I know this type of imbalance can seem unfair. I dealt with objections to this practice at Netflix too. Say we wanted to bring in a person from another company whose salary was about twice what everybody else on the team was being paid. Department heads would sometimes ask, "Does that mean I'm paying my people half of what they're worth? Are they all underpaid by 100%? I'd ask back, "Well, is this new person going to be able to move us faster, maybe even twice as fast? And when we hire him, which of the people on your team could take his place at his former company?" The answer was usually, "Well, yeah, we'll be able to move much faster, and none of them could replace him because they don't have his experience." We also decided at Netflix that rather than offer new hires what would be widely deemed a reasonable increase over their pay at their former job, we would pay top of market and insist on high performance. Say a manager is interviewing two people with very similar backgrounds. The woman makes $130,000 and the man makes $150,000, a common discrepancy due to the long history of wage discrimination. They're comparably good. Should the manager offer both of them $160,000? The answer is, emphatically, yes. But when I offer this advice, I often get the reaction, "That's crazy. I mean, if we give her $140,000, she's going to be over the moon." People often also respond that it would be fiscally irresponsible to spend more of the company's money than they have to. But that's if you're thinking only about keeping to a budget, rather than about the value the person will generate for you, hopefully for quite a few years beyond your current budget year. Not to mention that pegging salary offers to pay history has perpetuated the pay bias that's led to women being underpaid across so much of our workforce. That, rather than the imbalances due to results contributed, is the inequity that companies should find unfair and unacceptable. In my experience, if you focus intently on hiring the best people you can find and pay top dollar, you will almost always find that they make up much more in business growth than in the difference in compensation. The magical thinking of signing bonuses. Of course, one of the ways companies try to contend with market pressure to elevate compensation for key hires is bonuses,
which have gotten more and more elaborate and ill-conceived.
When I was at Borland, we were hiring a guy who lived 30 miles away, and the manager told me to add a relocation bonus to his offer.